The first is Dr. Gary Quick, who now serves as Associate Professor and Research Director in the Division of Emergency Medicine at St. Louis University School of Medicine here in St. Louis. And Dr. Quick will give us the medical perspective. Dr. Quick.
Thank you. It's an honor to have an opportunity to address you. I usually take liberties with physicians and presume on their vocabulary and their ability to handle gallows humor. I hope I don't subject you to too much of that presumption today. I wanted to start, it's impossible to cover the whole field of AIDS with as much information as is burgeoning now. There are approximately 5 journals a month that present information on AIDS, but I want to focus on certain parts that I think may be apropos to you and refer you to the handout, which is indexed and referenced and will be useful for you to work through. Some of them are cherry and some of them are white. If you get the cherry, it's the same as the white. I'd like to tell you what AIDS is like by starting with 4 brief cases. They're little glimpses of patients that have actually been seen in the emergency department here in the area. The first is David. He's 23 years old, a hemophiliac who has watched his 2 brothers die of AIDS. He is HIV positive. He now has deteriorated down the slide of immunity to the point where he has AIDS, and he comes to the emergency department about every 3 days for pain relief, for bleeds into his tissues from the hemophilia, and this is punctuated by decremental signs in his immune system that he is no longer able to handle the kinds of infections that are assaulting his system. His mother has now witnessed 3 sons, 2 of whom are dead, and 1 left living on his way to death. There was John, seen several months ago, who came in with swollen glands for 2 weeks. And these days, we can't let people go with just swollen glands for 2 weeks. It was apparent that he was anxious. And so I said to him, John, are you worried that you have HIV? And he said, yes, I am. And we talked about risk factors, and we went ahead with his HIV test, which was positive, in fact. I had never seen a woman with AIDS until about 3 years ago, and I saw a young lady named Mary. She had just received from the health department the news that her HIV test was positive and that her CD4 count was around 400, which put her right on the margin of having AIDS, and she was pregnant. She didn't know that she was pregnant, but she said, I need to have a pregnancy test because I've missed a few periods and I don't know what to do. I think I'd better abort this baby if I have AIDS. And then there was Dalton, who came in for the 2nd time, comatose, having overdosed on drugs, knowing his HIV status and his AIDS and the fatal outcome that was looking him in the face, and deciding that life was not worth going on. We like to think that that doesn't happen to people like us, but our behavior really is fairly frail. And when you begin to knock props out of us one at a time, sometimes those thoughts in an impetuous time can begin to infringe on our lifestyle and our consciousness. Jerry, the first slide, please. I'm an associate professor and research director at St. Louis University. I was medical director at Barnes Hospital until Barnes became too unstable for me, and I moved to St. Louis University. Next slide, please. You'll have difficulty reading this from the back. All the information that I have presented is in your brochure, so don't worry about trying to find it, but you will have to read the brochure to get it out. We're not sure how AIDS started. It probably started with some link to animal infection, which has been present in Africa for years. Whether it actually made the leap to humanity by ritualistic sacrifices of monkeys or drinking monkey blood or injecting monkey blood to prove one's machoism or manhood, is unclear whether it actually sprung to humanity from polio experiments that you may have perhaps read about, of which there are very poor records kept, an ethical issue, no doubt. We're not sure, but it does appear that the roots of this blight are in Africa, possibly spread to men or women in the 1950s. The first serological evidence that we have is 1953, and it spread slowly and then explosively in many epidemics in certain subsets of populations across the face of the world, and it has not quit. It attacks indiscriminately men, women, and children. It was detected first by medical technology in the United States, and then probably the most serious misdiagnosis and political cover-up and whatever else you want to call it occurred in this century, and that is that it was listed as an American gay or homosexual curiosity. Traced to its probable roots in Africa 2 to 3 years later. And I'm not saying that people intentionally covered it up. I'm saying that the error was there, and we had the African experience that no one had yet defined. Next slide. What has been the African impact? Well, there's some lessons that we need to learn here. One is that educational campaigns were ineffective, because we were dealing with the fact that society was used to multiple sexual partners and there were cultural and religious beliefs that were implicated in the spread of this epidemic. And I submit to you that we have the same problems confronting us. They may not be the same partners, but they're still multiple partners. And there are cultural beliefs, cultural practices in this country that are just as detrimental to the isolation and control of this epidemic as in Africa. In the world view, in the world scene, AIDS is spread mostly through heterosexual contact. Less than 10% of the patients, the victims of AIDS on the continent of Africa have died. You'll see what this means shortly. What it says very clearly to us at this point is the pandemic, the worldwide epidemic, is in its infancy, no question. Next slide. A picture's worth a thousand words. The black widow is spinning her web. Every country in the world has reported AIDS at this point, and the web is being spun tighter and thicker and tighter and thicker as we speak. The reporting styles and reporting inaccuracies are present, but they never overestimate the severity of this epidemic. This indeed is the epidemic of the century. Next slide. There's talk about a plateau. In the cases of new HIV infection and new cases of AIDS, this is a patent, bald-faced, blatant lie. And it comes about because of a kind of misunderstanding of statistics. If you consider that 10 years ago, there were only 15 or 20 cases of AIDS, and you added 40 cases the next year, and 70 cases the next year, you get a rather meteoric rate of rise of new AIDS cases. Once you get a repository of a few hundred thousand cases, then to add 100,000 cases a year makes very little rate of rise difference, but you've added 100,000 cases a year. Next slide. Without pointing fingers, because we are all impugned in this situation in the sense that we participate in the human race, this is where we are at the threshold of this epidemic at this point. You perhaps recall reading in the papers several months ago that there are now many thousand cases of thyroid cancer in the fields and villages around Chernobyl from the meltdown that occurred there. Well, the same thing has happened to us over the past decade, where now we see life beginning to be taken by this vicious plague, whereas years before it was simply a matter of numbers and they seemed quite small. We are at the threshold, at the infancy of this epidemic. Next slide. Let's set it in perspective. Worldwide, the World Health Organization, as of November 1991, presented 500,000 cases of AIDS in the world, 1 million deaths. The most important thing is the HIV infection, because there are 10 million adults and 1 million children. You can read in that column, future deaths. We are already looking at an epidemic that will take not only 1,500,000 in the left-hand columns, but already will add another 11 million to the deaths before the next 5 to 10 years is out. Interestingly, the World Health Organization has boosted its estimate in 1991 from what you see on the slide to 10 million, up 1 million because of a gross underestimate. They now estimate 11 million cases of AIDS in the world as of last year, projecting 10 million before the year was up. Next slide, please. Graphically, this shows you how one could easily be lulled into not looking at the statistics and hearing that there is a plateau in the new cases of AIDS. Each of the purple columns represents new cases of AIDS. Therefore, if you added on the left-hand side the first three or four columns, you would see a rather rapid rate of rise. And you could say, well, it's plateaued there on the right-hand columns. However, the first 100,000 cases took 8 years to develop. The second 100,000 cases took 2 years. The third 100,000 cases will not take a year. I think this explains the facetious and treacherous rumor that's spreading at the present time that AIDS has reached a plateau. Next slide, please. Let's look locally. This is St. Louis, St. Louis County. There's an interesting thing about this, and that is that 10 years ago there was a syphilis outbreak. The health department has records of it here in St. Louis. And the syphilis outbreak occurred in the homosexual community and in the drug abusing community. Those people now are on the screen as AIDS cases. The thing that needs to penetrate into our wakefulness and into our mind at this point is there's presently another syphilis epidemic going on that has been going on for about 2 years here in the St. Louis area. The rate of syphilis is at least triple what it has been for the past 7 to 10 years. And the people that are implicated in this syphilis epidemic are mostly women. There are some men, IV drug abusers, new additions to the homosexual community, new IV drug abusers, but a large percent are women. This is a frightening thought for the St. Louis community as it is for every other urban setting in the United States, because what this represents is AIDS is making the leap from small subsets of the population, i.e. homosexuals and IV drug abusers, into the mainstream heterosexual population. And this is what happens. We're looking at what is now transpiring in Africa, perhaps occurring in the United States of America in all of our cities and towns. The prediction is that in another 2 to 10 years, those cases that have developed syphilis in the past 3 years will now be AIDS cases in the St. Louis area. The same trend is being seen everywhere there's an increase in sexually transmitted diseases. Next slide, please. This is a cumulative total of AIDS cases in the United States. The first column on the left, 177,000 in May of 1991, rose to 202,000 in November of 1991. A 6-month interval, a 22,000 improvement in number of cases. That's no plateau. The AIDS deaths on the run a parallel track in the right-hand column. Deaths 100,000 as of May 1991 and 144,000 as of November. 44,000 additional deaths in 6 months. The most important figure to take home on that slide is the one in the middle, which says EST, HIV. That's estimated HIV infection in the United States at this point, 1.5 million. Read that as 2 to 5 years down the road, 1.5 million deaths in the United States. You can speculate on the reason for these underestimates that have occurred in anticipating the extent and severity and wide scope of this epidemic. However, it's based, by and large, in the depravity of man. You can list the sins: adultery, fornication, sexual sins, IV drug abuse, lying, failure to protect others, and then a variety of, quote, lesser sins that have contributed substantially and materially to this rampant, raging epidemic that is before us. Mark prostitution, for instance. The estimates are that the average prostitute sees 10 to 30 victims or clients, depending on how you want to name them, per day in the United States. Approximately 15 to 25% of those women are HIV positive. In Bangkok, there's a new epidemic that is just raging and has just struck the public health scene there with a multitude of prostitution situations there where the rates of positivity are higher than 30% at the present time. So this epidemic, though it is a disease, it is by and large a sexually transmitted disease, and it is by and large transmitted by illicit relationships, if you will. We'll talk more about the other side of things shortly. Next slide, Jerry. The other message you need to get across, you need to take home, if you haven't heard it already, is that AIDS is incurable. Not only is it incurable, there is no cure in sight. You may have read things in the paper that indicate there is treatment. The treatment they're talking about are the antiviral drugs called AZT and ZVD and DDI. Now, these are three drugs that cost about $800 to $1,200 a month for treatment to each AIDS patient. And all they have been able to accomplish is to slow down the rate of replication of the HIV virus inside the body. In terms of survival, they have caused an increase of survival in a matter of months over a disease that now spans 12 to 15 years from the time the patient is infected to the time the patient dies. A matter of months is a pittance to say that's medical treatment. There is no magic bullet. There is none on the horizon. A vaccine which might be effective in terms of reducing the rate of spread and protecting the individual who already is HIV positive is realistically at least 5 and perhaps 7 to 8 years distant. So what you read about field trials and positive responses of vaccination for HIV, you can automatically read in there +5 to +8 years, and with poor luck, 10 years or more before a vaccination is effectively developed. Part of that is to be laid at the feet of the government public health program. Part of that is to be laid at the feet of those research laboratories and pharmaceutical companies that could work harder in developing an HIV vaccine. And what I'm saying there is that vaccinations don't make $800 to $1,200 in treatment for like anti-HIV and anti-AIDS drugs do. for the for-profit margin. And in the United States, we use the private sector to develop vaccines. We don't use public health facilities, public health labs, to develop vaccines. And so we have this lack of connection and lack of strong stimulus to get our private sector to make an anti-HIV vaccine. The blame for that is multifactorial. It's not just one individual or one section of the federal government. Now, the good news in this picture, and we have to look at the good news every once in a while, is not very much, but I would like to present some of it for you now, and that is that not everyone who's exposed to HIV gets the disease. We have on record many, many couples in which one or the other spouse is HIV infected, and that fact has been known. There has been unprotected coitus between husband and wife in the normal marital state, and the spouse has not become infected. That having been said, all it takes is one exposure and you can get the infection. So the good news is relatively slim in that situation. Next slide. This is a listing of mortality from viral infections in humans. Most of you probably know that rabies is a bad thing to have. Rabies is more treatable than HIV because we have a vaccination for rabies and we have an immune globulin for rabies. So that if you get bit by a rabid skunk or a rabid bat someday, you can be immediately injected with antibodies against rabies and you can be given the vaccination. And in the time it takes the rabies virus to infiltrate your cells and begin to multiply, you can be given a passive immunity and then an active immunity that will fight off the rabies infection. And so rabies will be falling from its position of 99% as more and more companies get access to, and more and more countries get access to rabies vaccine. And HIV is grossly underestimated at 75% mortality because we have not had enough time pass since the identification of this virus for all those people who are HIV positive to die. That percentage continues to climb, and from what our infectious disease experts tell us, everybody who has HIV positivity will die of AIDS. Now, if you ask me whether there are going to be a few survivors, yeah, miracles happen. But you don't count on miracles when you're dealing with an infectious disease like this. You say, those people that are HIV positive are going to die. There's some bad actors down there in that list. Smallpox, most of us have some acquaintance of what it was like where you get covered with all these blisters, and it was 30% mortality if you got the major smallpox. My mother-in-law survived it, and I'm glad she did because she's a great cook and baker. And I don't know how she managed to survive it, but I'm thankful that the Lord spared her. Before the smallpox vaccinations were there, she survived it. Hepatitis B leads to hepatic failure, failure of your liver. It's eminently transmissible by blood transfusions and by blood exposure. Lassa fever, I was in Temple, Texas in an emergency department, and there was a case of Lassa fever that was supposed to be coming to us from Mexico. And the hospital set up laminar flow corridors and a laminar flow isolation room and insisted that everybody wear face masks and all kinds of other gear in preparation for receiving this patient. And it only has a 3 to 5% mortality rate. Polio has been vanquished more or less by the vaccination. Next slide, please. When you think about HIV and you look at it across the pattern of the world, it travels like a sexually transmitted disease along corridors of human travel where people go sexually diseases travel with them, and HIV spreads in accordance with those patterns. It's important to recognize that this is an infectious disease that travels by the same pathways that other sexually transmitted diseases carry by. Next slide. No one is immune. This is important from a couple of viewpoints. One, that if you get a common cold, you are immune to that virus because your immune system builds antibodies to that particular virus the next time you're exposed to that virus by an indiscreet cough or sneeze or exposure to droplets or whatever. Your body has identified cells that become active and lock up that infection and block it from coming into your system. No one with HIV develops effective antibodies against another attack of HIV. That's one of the treacheries of this disease. There are a few other things we need to know about immunity. One, can you safely have surgery? Well, yeah, you can. One or two cases out of 100,000 surgical procedures transmit HIV. One out of 100,000. Depends on the procedure. Open cardiac surgery, deep abdominal surgery carries a little bit risk, a little bit higher risk, probably 2.4 cases out of 100,000. But that's a fairly low risk. If you stick yourself with a needle, I tested my mortality the other day. I had a trauma victim come into the emergency department, and we were busy attempting a resuscitation on this young man. And in the heat of battle, I stabbed myself with a needle. The rate of transmission from trauma victims is about 5 out of 100. So I'm sitting here with a 1 in 20 chance of turning seropositive to HIV as I talk to you, and I won't know for probably the next 6 months to 3 years whether that, in fact, has occurred. But it happens all around us. The risk to healthcare providers and other care providers in HIV through needle stick transmission is about 1 in 325 needle sticks. For every 325 people that are stabbed, one will seroconvert. There are other diseases that do a better job than that. Hepatitis B, for instance, will convert about 100 times greater than HIV, and so we have other risks to think about too, but HIV is the one that's in the fore at the present time. About one case of HIV per 100,000 blood transfusions. The blood supply is really pretty clean at the present time. It wasn't back in 83, 84, 85, and 86 before we learned how to test it. The reason that there is one out of 100,000 at the present time is because a blood donor can have HIV and his system could have not yet produced antibodies to it that are detectable by the test. He gives his unit of blood during that window, and it may be as many as 3 months, 6 months, or even 3 years before he seroconverts or turns positive on the blood test. During that window, if he gives blood, it's not detectable by our test. And so if you get that transfusion, you get nailed. Now, those are minor. The major ones, and I need to emphasize this, are sexual intercourse, IV drug abuse, and homosexual practice in that order. The homosexuals are taking a little bit of a cue from what has gone on in the past decade, and they are now down third on the list. There is a stabilization in the rate of rise in the homosexual community of new HIV cases. It's not spectacular, but it's present, and the mainstream now is the threat, sexual intercourse and IV drug abuse. What about caregivers? What about the health professionals? What about the people whose loved one is HIV positive or who has AIDS? Can they safely participate in usual activities? Well, yes, they can. There's no evidence that kissing or hugging or living with somebody in the pure sense, living in the same house, so to speak, drinking after them, sharing bathroom facilities or anything like that, has resulted in transmission of HIV. And so the greatest risk at this point for caregivers is not from HIV itself, but is from attendant diseases, especially tuberculosis, as you've been reading about presently in the papers, where because of the fall in immunity, generalized immunity of an HIV or AIDS patient, then other exposed diseases, other diseases to which they've been exposed, such as tuberculosis, become rampant and active. And now a little bit of humor. The next slide. This is the old surgeon's law. In medicine, you know, we've talked about rules and laws. You heard Dr. Klotz yesterday, right? Well, the gist of this adage has been somewhat contorted by HIV. It used to mean, I'll read it for you in the back in case you can't, there are old surgeons and bold surgeons, but not old, bold surgeons. That used to be a statement that meant that as a surgeon gets years of experience, he gets wisdom that comes born of that experience so that he knows who he can operate on safely and he knows who has the chance for the least morbidity and mortality. And so he becomes wiser and he doesn't make those impetuous decisions that he would have made in his unwisened years. Well, HIV has brought a rapid truncation of the surgeon's training in the sense that now surgeons turn conservative much earlier. And those that don't end up seroconverting and their careers are shortened by virtue of HIV and AIDS. So it is still true. This is one of those laws that passes generations, if you will, that there are old surgeons and bold surgeons, but not old, bold surgeons. Next slide, please. This will be a little hard for you to see. I think I'm going to come up here, and I can talk louder. Can you still hear me? I want to point part of this out to you, because this is what happens when HIV infects a cell. This is called the latent phase, and this is the active phase. The outer cell membrane, chromosomal DNA sits here in the nucleus. You see there's typified by another circle, and this is the cytoplasm of the cell. The red is viral DNA. To another lymphocyte. And that's how HIV begins to destroy your immune system. There's a triple layer of protection for the virus in the nucleus of that cell, the outer cell membrane, the cytoplasm, and then the nuclear membrane. Most antibiotics work either on the outer cell membrane or inside the cell. Antiviral drugs in this situation have to get into the DNA, into the control center of the cell, and inactivate the virus in there, and it very likely can't be done effectively without destroying the cell. The side effects of antiviral medicine are often the same effects of anti-HIV in the sense that the cell that's responsible for your immunity ends up being killed by the treatment. That's not good form. We don't do that. It's not ethical. This little devil has another way of handling things. You see the membrane budding out? When that membrane buds out, it takes a part of the cell wall the cell membrane with it. And so it not only loots the cell and mutinies against the cell commander, if you will, in the nucleus of the cell, but it rips the back off the cell as it goes out and causes the cell to have holes in it. I'll show you some graphic pictures of this shortly. And so the role of active non-HIV infections cause activation, multiplication, and dissemination of that virus throughout the system. Next slide. Here is a little more elaborate sketch of the same thing. The HIV virus approaches this T helper immune cell, jettisons its RNA into the cytoplasm by melding or blending with the membrane. This forms DNA and then makes its way into the cell where it takes over the command post. And now the cell nucleus has to do what the virus wants it to do. Biochemical basis. There's no way around it. It has taken over the command post of the cell. And now, when the cell nucleus becomes activated, it again commands the cell to make more HIV, and then the new HIV virus buds off. Next slide. These are electron micrographs. Here you have part of the cell, and these little bits that you can't see here are HIV virus. Look at them. Are the agents of the black plague. And you can see, they're not one at a time in the cell. They're there by large numbers. How large a number? At what time? I don't know, but they're not there singly. And so, not only is there mutiny in the cell nucleus, but there's also diversion of the cell function so that it no longer can produce the antibodies to effect protection against the disease which is attacking, and then to add insult to the injury, as the virus leaves, it takes part of the cell membrane with it. And so the cell is weakened by the loss of that membrane. Next slide. This is an electron micrograph, not a section of the cell, but a whole cell. And I would point out to you not these large structures, but these little structures. Are HIV virus exiting from this cell. An actual picture of how many viruses are exiting from this T4 cell. Now, if you conclude that that cell has lost membrane and has a weakened spot where the virus has exited, that cell is worthless. Its control center is damaged, so it doesn't work properly anymore. Its cell membrane has been damaged, and all of its energies and productivity have gone to producing HIV. And this patient just lost one notch on his CD4 count by those viruses exiting that cell. Next slide. This is an important concept that my wife didn't understand. If she didn't understand it, I suspect some of you don't either. Increasing number of viruses on this axis, decreasing CD4 count on this axis. You start off with this many CD4 cells, or kind of lymphocytes, kind of blood white cells. Over time, 0.0 being the time that you are exposed to the HIV infection, you have this many CD4 cells. As viral replication, as noted here, takes place, there's a gradual upward curve in the number of viruses that are produced. Those viruses are produced at the expense of a dropping CD4 count, because the only way you get more virus, recall the previous slide, these viruses are leaving the CD4 cell and leaving behind the damaged cell. As that count drops, the number of viruses increase, the number of CD4 cells reaches this point of 400, and as the plunge is below 400, the opportunistic infections of AIDS start, and those are the infections that cause patients to die. At this point, there's a meteoric increase in the number of HIV virus and
The virus is no longer latent, it's present in the patient's bloodstream, it's seeping forth from the outside. It is at this point that the patient has AIDS. During this period of time, it ranges from a matter of a year or two in the youngsters, the newborns, and what have you, up to about 10 years or perhaps 15 years that the patient can carry that HIV virus in his bloodstream, and from day one, he is infectious. This is stage one, stage two, stage three, and it's not until you get to stage four of this disease that AIDS actually is present.
This is a bad actor. We don't have any other illnesses like that that are infectious for a decade or a decade and a half, invisible, unless the patient has had a blood test to detect it, and then will kill you at the end of that time. Next slide. This is Kaposi sarcoma. It was one of the things that led us on to AIDS as it was first identified in this country. It's an opportunistic malignancy, but it's not really related directly to the CD4 count. I thought I'd show you that just because it was part of the original definition of AIDS, but it's not related to the falling CD4 count. Next slide. There are issues. We're now going into the kind of futuristic side of this lecture, and I have to truncate it a bit, but I've covered it well in the handout for you. There are many issues that threaten to ride ramshod right over our healthcare system at this point, from the number of patients that will be admitted, to the chronicity of the disease, to the magnitude of the pathology that's present in each patient, to provider and patient relationships that will be made difficult by suspicions of who's got HIV and who doesn't have HIV, who's got AIDS and who doesn't. And next slide. To the fact mentioned earlier today that in 1991, the World Health Organization felt that they needed to upgrade the number of HIV estimated new cases by 1 million. In the year of 1991, the projections are not yet out for 92. Next slide. Who's going to pay? This is what's happened over the years, and here we're talking from 1983 to 1988. This is what happened in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles to the number of AIDS cases treated on Medicaid. Now, these three communities happen to have the highest concentration in the country at this point, but those are upward trends. So this is what's called the Medicaidization of AIDS. And you need to read about this because of the implications for this in our healthcare system. Public health policy is covered on page 35 in your handout. There's a table of contents in the beginning. I want you to check off pages 31, 32, 33, and 35, because that's information that, unless you read editorials in medical journals, you're going to have a hard time getting out. This information has great public health impact. It will give you a perspective on HIV and the present AIDS epidemic that most people in this country don't have at the present time. I'm reluctant to call it an expose, but it's something like that. Next slide. This is what's happened to private insurance payments for AIDS. Over 4 to 5 years. Now, what this is predicated on is the fact that once people develop AIDS, they don't work very long. And most private insurance in this country is tied to employment. So, you resign your employment, you give up your insurance benefits. Seems rather ironic that the people who paid in at the peak of their working careers would be the ones who would lose private coverage. But because of the way our system is, if you're no longer employed, you don't have private insurance. The private insurers have the right, so to speak, and this becomes a strong ethical issue for us to consider, and it by no means has been resolved. If the patient converts to HIV, then private insurers feel in many circumstances they can refuse coverage because it was a pre-existing condition. How can you argue? If you develop AIDS, it's been present at least 2 years, 5 years, 10 years in terms of HIV infection preceding. And so you're caught in a technicality because of the nature of this disease, and you lose your insurance coverage, and that puts you on Medicaid in that circumstance. Next slide. Time for a little breath of humor. Now, there's an ironic twist to this. The best laid plans of mice and men are usually about equal. The amount of planning and the attack for containment and discovery of HIV infection is about that effective. I don't know who Blair was, but his wisdom also spans the generations. Next slide. This is censored by request of my wife. We've covered a lot of medical terms. It's about as funny as you can get when you talk about AIDS.
Gary, what doctors do when treatment fails. Epilation, dilate. Overstay the Lord's time. Live long. Enema, not a friend.
Now, enjoy your laugh. Next slide. Starting at the Civil War and going through the Vietnam War, we have suffered 566,000 mortalities in this country. 1981 to 2010. Alone, most of them between the current ages of 10 and 44 years of age. I believe that's an underestimate. I believe there'll be more than 750,000. More than all our wars, the suffering and dying humanity continues to need the message of hope and healing. We have little from the medical side to offer in that direction. Medicine can deal partially with this blight, with the physical aspects of infection, pain, and treatment modalities. Who can deal with the souls and spirits of men and their relatives as they lie dying? Thanks be to God, He gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ.
Thank you, Dr. Quick. Next, we have a legal perspective Mr. Donald Prevalet, attorney at law with the firm of Reed, Burge, Prevalet, and Coleman in Blytheville, Arkansas, is the presenter.
We did not have the opportunity to work together on this. I'm going to treat this as a jury argument, and it's not like, as some of you have said, the pastor preparing his sermon, because you know what you're going to say. Jury arguments are made when the opposing side finishes its evidence. Judge looks at you and said, make your argument now. Doctor did an excellent job. He took a good percentage of mine. Talk, so I'm going to work with it, and you see if you're quick enough to catch where I wire around him. I want to tell you three things before I begin. Number one, my statistics on women who are catching AIDS, I will not give to you, but it's much higher, doctor, even than the ones that you found. I'm talking about the relative percentage of women today who are catching AIDS as opposed to two, three, four, 5 years ago is much higher. So they're coming right along because of a number, of course, the way it's transmitted. Number two, I did some research, as he did. I won't bother you with it. I hesitate to share this with you because you're never sure about this, but some of you seemed interested, and I watched the jury out there taking notes. The patient zero theory is, how do we get this? How do we track it down? My research says that it's credited to a man whose name was Gaetan, G-A-E-T-A-N, Dugas. Mr. Dugas was a steward for an international airline, a major international North American airline, not in the United States. And they traced 40 cases to him in 1980. Of course, we didn't know what AIDS was at the time. Subsequent research indicates there were in existence prior AIDS cases. Those of you in the medical field who do research know that it's impossible with the statistics today to begin to trace how this got started. You have all the theories, the God's retribution theory, you know, and everything that the doctor discussed on how it got started. If you're looking for that to come out of this talk, I'll give you that name. I have no guarantee that that's true. My part of this is in 30 minutes to give you an overview of the legal perspective of AIDS. When I first looked at this, I started to tell Dr. Bacon and Dr. Klotz that I thought they'd made a mistake and this was going to be a subliminal test of your religion. And by that I meant if you or a member of your family have were told you have AIDS, who do you go to first? It would be the doctor. I suppose they were checking to see that really it should be the theologian should be first, because if you have the strong enough faith, that's the man you should go to, then the doctor, and finally get down to the lawyer. But when it comes time to questions of may I try some experimental drug, what rights do I have to get in the hospital, do I have to tell my fellow employees, how will my insurance benefits be affected, must my employer know, things like that, you are going to have the lawyer. Dr. Johnson, who may or may not be in the audience, made some reference last night to Shakespeare. He didn't have that quite right. Dr. Mortimer made some reference to the fact when he looked rather plaintively at Dr. Klotz last night, and he said, you know, we're the second lowest paid people in Russia. You at the banquet, you remember that? And he looked over at Dr. Klotz, and he said, actually, you know, the theologians are probably the lowest paid people in Russia. What they really didn't tell you is that Lenin was a student of applied principles of theology, of application of theology. Lenin studied, if my history is right, and I hadn't had time to go out and read on this, but I think he was in England for a while. I think they eventually put him in a boxcar and sent him back to Russia just to promote trouble. And he studied theology in England, and he studied the primary principles, as a good Missouri Synod would, of historical grammatical theory as opposed to the higher critical theory. So when Lenin got back to Russia, he remembered his Shakespeare, to which Dr. Johnson made reference last night about the reference about the lawyers. And Lenin promptly applied the historical grammatical inerrancy theory of what to do with lawyers rather than the higher critical theory of lawyers. So when it came time to compare what the lawyer's salary was in Russia last night, there was no finishing third. I know some Green Bay Packer fans out there, the coach said, you know, finishing third, but there were no lawyers left in Russia at that time. The thing we're supposed to start with is a joke. I'm not used to a solid presentation like this, and I'm supposed to get your interest. So I've spent a lot of time, and I want your attention now, because I'm about to tell you every really funny joke I've learned and studied and got AIDS. And when I finish this, I'm going to give you an opportunity. Now, I'm not talking about sardonic humor, black humor, blue humor. I'm talking about real funny jokes about age. Okay, you ready? All right, you've just heard every funny joke I know about AIDS. If any of you know anything that's funny about AIDS, to help this program be pepped up a little bit, you got 2 minutes of my time. You can stand up where you are, or you can approach a microphone. We'll give you... The point is made. There's nothing funny about AIDS, nothing funny at all. I want you to know that AIDS is a 10-year disease, and there are already law schools. They have 2- and 3-hour courses in AIDS law. So this is the complexity of this is just burgeoned just beyond anything that you can possibly imagine. I trained the speaker at the Senate convention in Pittsburgh who made the remark, the chairman of the Commission on Constitutional Matters, and he said he was like the kamikaze pilot on his 22nd mission. Some dedication, not too much sure commitment about how he could get the job done. Let me tell you that the doctor also covered a good share of my statistics, but I'm going to play one little game with you, then we're going to really get into this. I want you to take the one statistic that he didn't cover, unless I missed it, and I apologize, Dr. Quick, if I did. I want you to fix in your mind how many people you think, according to the latest newspaper clipping, will have AIDS by the year 2000. Now, he really gave you a lot of help. He gave you a running start. Everybody, real quickly, fix in your mind how many AIDS patients, with the virus, not dying of AIDS, but will have the virus by the year 2000. In a word, sunset, 9 o'clock in this decade, past sunset in this century. By the year 2000, how many people do you think will have AIDS? Okay, in 10 seconds, everyone raise your hand. Quickly, raise your hand. Quick, everybody raise your hand. If you thought it was 10 million people or less, put your hand down. Rest of you, keep your hands up. If you thought it was 25 million people or less by the year 2000, put your hands down. Okay, we got some goers. If you thought it was 75 million people by the year 2000 that will have the AIDS virus or less, put your hand down. I may have a winner, gold star. How about 100 million people with the AIDS virus on this God-given planet Earth by the year 2000 or less? Put your hand down. I've got two left in the back. Statistics are, according to the Harvard researchers, and there are the CDC, of course, the Center for Disease Control, and you put your hands down back there. You may be leaning... I'm sorry, I thought you had your hand up. You're leaning on that doorpost back there. You don't get any gold star after all. I tell you, this is serious. I mean, I'm trying to put a little bit of interest because we have the middle program late in the afternoon. But put that statistic down for you note takers for the pastor's confirmation class. 100 million people will have the AIDS virus, if you believe the Harvard research team, by the year 2000. 100 million God-given souls. So let's get on with this. We have some problems. We have some serious problems. And this is going to overcome the legal system as well as the medical system and the theological system, I think, and everything. This is indeed the plague of the century. I want to talk to you first of all about criminal law. And you're going to say, hey, look, we don't want to hear about criminal law. Okay, you cannot consider AIDS law today without some addressing of the issue of criminal law, simply because criminal law makes up a huge percent of the law today. The idea of a criminal offense and a conviction for passing on a what the English call a vile and loathsome disease is not new. Now, the original case was somewhere, I think, in 1866, Regina, the Crown versus Bennett. A young man was convicted of passing his disease on to his niece. Said nothing about a trial for that relationship, but anyway, they did convict him and stood up on appeal. It's a reported case, and apparently he gave her what we today would call syphilis. Now, here we are 130 years later, and we are still faced in this country and struggling with the type of criminal laws that would prevent this type of activity. You obviously can't prevent this type of activity with criminal law. Any jurisprudence student knows that. But what to do about this? Do you make it a crime? Every state in the union, in the state in which you come from, says this is a crime to do this. It is a crime to transmit this type of disease, especially a crime to attempt to do it deliberately. I will be quickly, briefly. Lafayette, Indiana, 1988, two police officers, Officer Dennis and another, his partner, get a call to go to the home of one Haynes. Attempted suicide, wrist slash, blood all over the place, scene of havoc. Dennis tries to revive Haynes, who wakes up screaming at him and says, "I have AIDS, I want to die." Charges him, tries to bite him, spits at him. He spits blood and slings blood in Officer Dennis's mouth. He somehow gets a hold of a blood wig. I don't know how a wig got into that, but he took the blood-soaked wig, slashed him with it, and got blood in his face and everything. He bit two EMTs, for those of you who are EMTs, and he bit two of those to hospital, and they convicted him of 3 counts of attempted murder. That's probably the most severe criminal crime you're going to get, attempted murder. I'd read that case before, and last Friday, getting ready to come up here, I picked up the phone. I just called Lafayette, Indiana Police Department, and I got a man who politically incorrect identified himself as, quote, only a dispatcher. You're not supposed to say that today, of course. I said, "You ever hear about this case?" And he said, "I think so." And I said, "The big question I've got is, whatever happened to Officer Dennis? Is he alive?" He said, "Yes, I think so." Said he works in commercials. It's slang for bad checks, I think. So apparently, thank the Lord, Officer Dennis is still alive. But the strongest criminal conviction, we're going to get over this in a hurry, is attempted murder. You must prove that the individual had the means and the wherewithal to accomplish it, and he had the intent, and that's what he tried to do. I will tell you that courts are extremely reluctant in your respective states to make a conviction on AIDS. They usually try to go on something simpler and easier, like simple assault or battery, just the biting or the scratching. Because doctors, they're still having a terrible time trying to determine whether AIDS can, in fact, be transmitted by the bite. You get into questions of, did he break the skin with his teeth, or did, you know, something else break it? So they have lesser included offenses. Now, quickly, criminal law defenses to that today are things like informed consent. In other words, she knew, he knew what we were going to do, and she knew, he knew I had AIDS. It shouldn't be a crime. One of the interesting defenses to criminal charge today is insanity. People are arguing that the AIDS virus attacks not only the brain and immune system, but also it attacks your right to reason, and hence you have no right, you can't convict because they cannot form the requisite mental intent. I should digress briefly and tell you that all the AIDS and homosexual groups are into all these issues. I mean, this is a very complex issue today with a lot of lobbying power, a lot of free briefs, a lot of manpower going into it. The way that backfired is people who attempted to leave wills then and to leave property to their significant other or their whatever terminology they use for their roommate today and decide rather to leave the property to their blood family rather than their homosexual roommate, suddenly the families came back in and said, "All right, if they're incompetent by reason of insanity to commit criminal offenses, then they don't have the requisite mental capacity to write a will or leave their property to anybody." So that kind of backfired, and they started coming back off of that. But most states have a statute that makes it a felony, and I quote just a sample, commits the felony of exposing another to HIV if she's been tested, knows she has it, and gives it to someone else. Many of these cases come out of criminal situations. For those of you, I think it was mentioned this morning, those of you involved in criminal work, treating people in institutions, it's a terrible situation we have with us. They're incarcerated for some crime. They have AIDS. They know they're going to be there 4 or 5 years. Their future is non-existent. You can't control these people, and guards in these cases are having a terrible time of it. I would cover with you briefly next the fact that the insurance law. Doctor covered a good share of this for me, but let me tell you that you're going to have a real crisis in your insurance law today. Insurance, you get your policy through your employer. Employer pays part of it, you pay part of it, or else you buy a plain old Blue Cross policy. Okay. Those rates were based on so many people getting so many diseases out of every 10,000. AIDS has blown that to pieces, absolutely blown it to pieces. AIDS has also blown the other part of your insurance, not what you get back when you're sick, has also blown to pieces the part about liability coverage. Now, what does he mean by liability coverage? I mean, if you're responsible, some very innovative and competent plaintiff's attorneys have come up with the idea that if you have a homeowner's policy, for example, or if one of you live in a, some of you live in an apartment, apartment dweller's policy that covers your household goods also has a liability feature. Leave the motor, you know, roller skate on the sidewalk, mailman slips on it. But if you negligently give your guest AIDS, there are lawsuits being filed now saying that the homeowner's, the apartment dweller's liability policy should cover that negligent conduct. And some of these are going to court. So it's going to affect your rates. If you've got just a plain old State Farm, Allstate thing, unless they start winning these lawsuits, your rates, are, even though you're not directly affected, the amount of money you pay for insurance just for that is going to go up. The amount of the cost of a home treating a homosexual payment is going down. I have that good news for you. Insurance companies tried testing every applicant for a while, and the expense of that was just prohibitive. You absolutely could not test everyone who applied for it. That's gone out. What's happened in some of these cases the doctor made reference to is there are caps on the amount of benefits that you can get under your insurance policy. The big major case, I don't know if Gene Esch is here from Houston. He needs to watch the H&H Music Company in Houston. A young man in there had a cap went, and he had a $5,000 limit, went to federal court, and they argued that it was unconstitutional because there were higher limits for other coverages. Fifth Circuit, United States Fifth Circuit Appeals affirmed and said, no, they had a right to do that. Now, that is on appeal, but they had a cap of $5,000 on that. The employer says, look, if I'm going to provide regular coverage and protection for the rest of my people, I can't assume this type of coverage is going to bankrupt me. The plaintiffs say, look, there are unusually large limits of coverage for this type of thing, and I have every right to expect that I'm covered the same as everybody else here with a disease. Quickly, a lot of these cases you read about, Mark Christian, for example, suing Rock Hudson, fine name, Christian. You're going to find that most of these involve big-name people, big-profile cases, and big names for the transmission of it. Most of the AIDS cases that country lawyers, just poor working country lawyers that I ever see, people have no money, AIDS destitutes, absolute the pocketbook as well as the body. If you've got a chance to get something, that's where these big jury verdicts come in. I should tell you that my statistics show that 94% of all of the money spent for the treatment of AIDS in the last couple of years was spent in the United States and Western Europe and some industrialized countries. Yet 80% of the AIDS cases are coming from what are called the, quote, poor countries. Africa last year spent $400 per year for AIDS patients, $400 per year. My figure, the cost on AZT and the drugs that are doctor are quick or less than Dr. Quick's. But it's still very expensive. And many of these people simply in the poor countries cannot afford that crisis. Now, I want to talk to you about some things that I think will affect you, and I'm picking this up as I go along from the questions that were asked in the sessions this morning. Every state today has a statute that requires blood testing given for blood to be tested. Most states have a rule that if you flunk once, you're asked to give blood again. If you flunk it the second time, then they have a procedure that they follow. But what happens after that is a very different and diverse thing depending on the state that you're in. All states have a requirement that there be free blood testing for AIDS. The problem is this has only been relatively successful because people are reluctant because of the stigma to either be seen or to know, you know, if you know that Mary Jo went out and had a test for AIDS, you begin to look at Mary Jo, you begin to look at her family, and you're not sure about the whole thing. So they're afraid of leaks. As a quick aside, in the limited time I have, even street people who donate blood apparently are becoming computer literate. Part of the procedure, you know, if you've given blood is you take the barcode off this side if you think you got AIDS, this side if you don't, paste it in the middle and throw the other one away and the person leaves the room. That's better than the old fashioned interview. Now they're putting computer screens and keyboards in front of people leaving the room, and they have found that 14% more people will admit to probably having the possibility of AIDS than would admit even with taking little barcode seals and moving them back and forth across the paper. So the computers are making their way around in this world. The point of all this is, and I'm going to quote a statute and to you doctors out there, a physician whose patient is determined to have AIDS or test positive for the presence of the virus HIV antigen or antibodies shall immediately make a report to the State Department of Health in such manner and form as the department shall direct. Okay, so every physician today is required to present AIDS by the CDC ruling. You've got to present and make a notation to CDC. The fine differences you really have to pay attention to come in. What if you just got the virus and not AIDS? Okay, the statute says that the statute says, and we're trying this case this afternoon here in the state of Concordia. I cannot pretend to be your legal advisor for the state of Missouri or Indiana, Illinois, because I must tell you the law in every one of these states is different. I wish that I could. I can see what's coming on the panel. Some people have already said, but each state is different. So we're going to take the sample and make as quick as we can. It says that a patient who is determined to have that, it shall be kept secret, but it shall be reported. Now, it shall be kept secret, but it must be reported to the state health department. That's what I meant to say. Okay. Well, what I'm saying is that this is called an HIV shield law. Some of you are asking about this morning. An HIV shield law. These statutes simply say that informed consent, now those are words that mean certain things in law, informed consent is not required. If you are a health care provider or for a health facility that includes hospital, nursing home, blood banks, blood centers, sperm banks, other health care institutions, to perform a test when the health care employee or an employee of a health facility is involved in, quote, a direct or mucous membrane contact with the blood or bodily fluids of an individual which is of a nature or may transfer HIV as determined by a physician. You don't have to get his consent. The mechanics of this may not be that easy, but you can draw blood for a CBC or something like that and run and get it. The results of this test are to be provided to the person ordering the test, the affected health care provider, that's you if you work in that area, or the employee of the facility, to the care provider, to the employee's physician, and to the patient, and to the patient's physician. If this guy that you think gave you AIDS has a physician, his physician also knows. Okay, now, this will give you some protection, at least, and answer the question of how do I find out if I'm a fireman and I give resuscitation on this, you know, whether I can get this or not. Okay. There is a second part to this that a physician, if he has been asked our health care provider to just provide a medical examination, you also do not need to get a informed consent. If you think the patient has AIDS in most states, you can go ahead and have it tested on your own. You must have had at least a request from him to have some type of examination. And this is the law in most states. And you can do it. And if you find out that he has AIDS, then you are required to report that. Again, it's supposed to be secret. And you are required to tell the patient. But you need not tell anyone else about it. So this at least gives the physician some idea of how to get in there. All of these things, of course, are changing in the law, and they may change from day to day. I want you to know that in 1992, the National Commission of AIDS made a ruling that medical workers do not and are not required to disclose whether they have a virus. That was in August of this year. The National Commission of AIDS, appointed by the President and the Congress, ruled that medical workers are not required to disclose whether they have AIDS. The reasoning, it said, was that medical workers, and Dr. Quick covered some of this, should be protected, quote, from discrimination caused by the fear of AIDS. And the CDC is, in fact, meeting today to study this further. The AIDS Commission said that the patient's chances of catching AIDS from a doctor or nurse or dentist are so practically non-existent that no purpose would be served in enforcing these health workers to disclose their HIV status. The attorney for Kimberly Bagalis, that name strike, the lady who died from allegedly got AIDS in the dentist, I can't really tell you what he said about that ruling. Most people feel that they would prefer not to be treated by a health care provider who has the HIV virus. There are some arguments for both sides of this. I want you to know that the present administration, and you probably will not read about this, especially not in the next 30 days, at least not the way things are looking in Arkansas. The present administration, the Bush administration, is considering a policy that will require all HIV cases, this is the virus, not the full-blown AIDS, but just the virus, to be reported. required to be reported. That sexual contacts, pick up on that, that sexual contacts of all infected individuals would be notified, and that the federal medical coverage would be expanded to include treatment from all these people from the time of the original HIV diagnosis until death. Now, this has been very discreetly discussed inside the administration, the Public Health Service, because of the political ramifications involved. As I said, coming from Arkansas, I have some idea what politics is going on in the world today, and I doubt we'll see much of this in the next 35 to 40 days. But the program is justified that if you can trace one contact and prevent one case out of 50 of HIV or virus, the expense alone saved would justify the expense of tracing and the bureaucracy that put this whole program in order. I don't know if that's going to work or not, but it would be a big difference because it would start having to reporting and contact tracing all of these people. Again, I mentioned to you that all of the homosexual groups, civil libertarian groups, are well-intentioned. I don't want to be pejorative in my expression and coverage of these people, but there's a lot of politicking going on, a lot of objection to all this. You just can't imagine what goes on in Congress and this sort of thing. We are told today that the statistics show that there are approximately 360 surgeons, 5,000 other physicians, 12,000 dentists, and 35,000 healthcare workers who are practicing with the HIV virus, is the best estimate that we have. Now, we assume that they're using the proper practices and preventative practices. Before you say, look, they shouldn't be in there, I should note, and I'm not being defensive one way, I can see heads, the jury shaking heads both ways out there, is a lot of these people are dealing with other full-blown homosexual cases in nursing homes. They're treating people who they work with, you know, and if you say these people can't work in these homes, to some extent you're running in the area of treating people who already have AIDS, who are working with people who have full-blown AIDS. So all of this is something with which you're going to have to be concerned. In 1991, the OSHA requirements were changed, and you are now required to use certain gloves, certain preventive measures. There's no sense in me covering that. Employment. The American for Disability Act, again, overshadows all of this. How many of you, quickly, the ADA, you've heard about all the changes in the ADA. Okay, the ADA went into effect for companies that have 25 or more employees in July of 1992. The American for Disability Act says that you can no longer discriminate, as if you ever did, against people who are disabled, people who are perceived to be disabled, or people who associate with persons who are disabled. And it says this includes HIV-positive persons. Now, you have certain precautions there, and one of the questions that we asked yesterday about insurance benefits, I have here, and I wave at you, a 1991 Missouri Bar Journal written by someone I'm sure is extremely competent, and he says that the American for Disability Act requires employers to provide equal benefits to their employees under their insurance. This means there can be no overt discrimination on benefits. Thus, an employer may not refuse to include individual with AIDS on his medical insurance plan. I wave before you quickly AIDS and employment outlined by a law professor, the same thing, and it says, among other things, I have found no prohibition in federal law which excludes AIDS from coverage. So I don't know, until all of these things are tested by lawsuits, and the courts say exactly what those statutes mean. These issues of insurance coverage certainly are not resolved. I'm running out of time here. I want to mention to you briefly that for the pastors, that there are a lot of things that you need to consider, and I'm going to cover those with you, and I'm going to title them appropriately, Final Arrangements. What happens when your age parishioner dies? I hope you will take this home with you, be of some benefit to you. Many disputes have arisen, for example, over the arrangements and the conduct of a funeral after the death of the individual with AIDS. This can put you, if you're the pastor or the caregiver, in a very difficult situation. You need to just think about this before. What funeral home will be retained to conduct the services? Will the funeral home handle an AIDS patient? Some funeral homes have found, for example, that if they handle one, they'll get more, and soon they have sort of the reputation. And for reasons not clear, when you really think the whole situation through, even what we believe as Lutheran Christians, people don't want to take their deceased family member over there. Will the decedent be cremated, buried in the usual fashion? who will be allowed to attend the funeral services. For those of you pastors out there, I didn't mean to make this all business and all love, but there are other direct problems you will get involved in. These are hard questions to answer because you can already begin to think about it. You can see that especially the blood family takes the position that my loved one wouldn't be dead if this partner hadn't given he or she the AIDS. So they're not exactly welcome at the funeral service. How will the services be paid for? What do we do with the property? These people have been living together for 4 or 5 years. Who owns it? There's no will. The laws about the probate and the distribution of property after death are written solely for what you and I would consider the normal, usual relationship. Sometimes title to a house is held in a partner who dies. The blood family says, I want the house. And the homosexual partner says, no, I've lived here for the last 10 years, and I've made all these payments, and it's mine. You have major confrontations that you need to expect. I have no absolute advice for you. I would like, wish that I could, in closing. You need to suggest, if you can work with the people and are confident death is coming, that they leave some written instructions. Work with them in the best Christian way that you can. Try to get some sense of what this person really wants done. This is not easy to do. You have problems in assisting some of you and doctors in death certificates. What to put on death certificates? State law mandates death certificate and cause of death in every state. That doesn't mean, as Dr. Quick will be quick, I'm sure, to agree that you can't make, you know, died of cancer, you died of a form of pneumonia and what happened. But sometimes you're going to be called on to associate with that. What to put in obituary notices? Sometimes pastors are required to do that. It's the stigma. To help, to assist, not to write it, but at least to prevent the fear and the hostility among the family. All of these things come under, I think, the general umbrella of legal problems that arise in AIDS. As I said, I cannot cover everything that's in a 2 or 3 hour law course on AIDS in 30 minutes. I've done the best you can. You've been a fine jury. I hope you will go back and consider it. And when you reach your verdict at your hometown, as the decisions and items come up one by one, some of this may be of some benefit to you. Thank you.
A theological perspective is provided by Dr. Robert Weiss, who now occupies the chair of pastoral ministry and life sciences here at Concordia Seminary, a chair which is funded by Lutheran Charities of St. Louis. Dr. Weiss.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I really appreciate being asked to do this several months ago. This was done before I received the third call to this chair. And after I received the third call, I had to be terribly Lutheran in that and ask the basic question, what does this mean? But at any rate, I soon have had some discussions with some of my colleagues in the parish that are here, and they are coming up and congratulating me and telling me this is great. What a great promotion for you. It would be interesting to understand that in the doctrine of the call, but I had to assure them that, and some of the professors here would understand this, that professor does not translate into prophet. So those are some of the basic things I have to keep in my mind, and certainly I see some of you nodding off. Please feel free, that's okay. It makes me feel very comfortable that I'm back in the pulpit preaching. So at any rate, there are a few things I want to start off. I'm going to digress a little bit, because coming down here, people have great expectations for this chair. And I had to start someplace. So I started with genetic engineering. And they said, you know, it sure would be nice. And people have said this, that, you know, if Luther were here now, you know, a lot of our problems would be solved. He would have the answers for us. Well, I've tried. And I think the first overhead will show you that we kind of have failed. We tried Luther, and instead we got George Washington. So we're still working on that. But in the essence of collegiality, I also have tried one other thing. We have a very fine president of the seminary, a good theologian, and a good preacher, and a good speaker. We heard that yesterday evening. And he's a very busy man, and he needs to get around in a lot of different places. So is one Dr. John Johnson enough? Well, we've tried. But as I was passing his office, I saw the problem of two Dr. Johnsons. If we could see the next overhead. But we're working on this. It seems to be one of those things that happens when you get into the business of cloning. So I hope that they end up working that out. It's okay to laugh in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but not too much. I certainly come to you, though, with all seriousness regarding AIDS, 20th century black death. And I believe that the pastoral application, and I certainly want to remain in that area. I have been reminded of that many, many times by many of the pastors in the Central Illinois District and down here. Please keep a pastoral perspective. Pastors, when dealing with persons with AIDS, we have a lot to deal with. It's not like putting your laundry into the washing machine, as some would say, where people are trying to tell me, and this is the way we wash our clothes, as we have the answers. Because as you well know, when it all comes out, the laundry's not done in the same way. Sometimes there are many, many wrinkles. And so I choose not to deal with the issue of homosexuality, although I will address that later on. I choose to deal with our relationship to God, the first table of the commandments, and the second table, our relationship to people. And to do that, we're going to start off with just a little bit of history as we skip this rock across the water, not having a lot of time, but as you well know, preachers don't look at the clock when they get in the pulpit. Times mean that means absolutely nothing. So we'll just keep on going here. But I think pastors, the teachers, the DCEs, the healthcare professionals that are here, the volunteers that work hard in dealing with all these areas, all of these things are applicable in terms of the great pestilence, the Black Death, we now are dealing with, which is likened unto AIDS. I would like to start off with this. In Matthew chapter 22, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with a question. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first greatest commandment. The second greatest commandment, the second is like this. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. That is the word of the Lord. In the great pestilence, the Black Death, that goes way back to 1348, there are uncanny parallels when one takes a look at that Black Death and AIDS. They are absolutely uncanny regarding how physicians, clergymen, laity, how they all reacted to this horror, this tragedy of bubonic plague. There was chaos, there was fear, there was confusion, there was desertion, and then there was the stagnant, pungent odor of dead bodies being piled up in every nook and cranny in Europe. When the Black Death came, it came to stay, and it is still here today. It has not been eradicated. The plague did come to an end in the sense of being able to treat it several hundred years later, of course. But there is a plague in AIDS. The Black Death, it is horrible and it is tragic. The homophobic, and the outline that I have you, and I guess in good Luther way, we'll try and follow that. We're not going to be able to stick to all of that. this homophobic, as I call it, schizophrenia, the split mind. Oh, yes, I'm a pastor, and I love everybody, and I'm going to talk about Christ. And then when a homosexual comes into your office and says, I have AIDS, and it's kind of like, back. There is a great fear out there. I don't want to overplay it or underplay it. But those of you who have dealt with AIDS, those persons with AIDS, understand that. Perhaps it's not a homophobic schizophrenia. It is also maybe more likened to a homophobic mania. It is penetrating every level of society. Every nook and cranny is filled with, do something now, they're telling the physicians. And do something now. The plague, there is little escape from it. And it's insidious, ominous, secretive attack pattern. The Black Death came in various forms. Came to an end. AIDS seems to be interminable, boundless, incessant, imperishable. Its undyingness causes those men and women with AIDS to die. And so the plague and AIDS causes us to re-examine our Christian reaction and our Christian responsibility. And so we'll take a look at AIDS as redeemed by the body and blood of Jesus Christ and how it is comparable to the reactions and the responsibility observed during major plagues and pestilences of history.